I refuse to testify on the grounds that my organs will be chopped up into a patty.
Ah, the 67th Amendment.
I move for a bad court thingy.
You mean a mistrial?
Yeah, that's why you're the judge and I'm the law talking guy.
In contempt of this court.
I have nothing but contempt for this court.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode number 99. I'm your host, Thomas Smith. That over there is your other host, Andrew Torres. How's it going, Andrew?
It is going well. This is, I am now back from vacation by the time you hear this. And you are almost certainly a proud papa by the time we hear this. So, going well. Not as good as, last Friday, though.
Yeah, back to the grind. But that doesn't matter because we've got an incredible Q&A episode for you. That's all you need to worry about. I love these. They're my favorite episodes, really, because everybody has so many questions for Andrew, and he has to do his best to answer them on the fly. Doesn't get to, you know, prepare ahead of time, but he still does an incredible job. It's frankly a little insulting to everybody else how good Andrew is at this. But,
so well, now I'm blushing, but I do love doing these shows. I really enjoy the interaction we have with our listeners, and they're a lot of fun. So let's get on to the questions.
All right, let's do it. Let's get over to that Q&A.
He who questions training only trains himself at asking questions.
What?
We go, Andrew. You ready? Let's see if you can handle this. I don't know, because Andrew doesn't get to prep for these, so we'll have to see how lawyerly, how many belts and suspenders he has on right now.
Yeah, one of each, but keep going.
Yeah, there you go. It's a belt and the suspenders lawyer. David Dial asks, what is spousal privilege actually, and what does it cover? Because there's a lot of misunderstanding around this. There's some really good Arrested Development jokes about this, which is why I laughed. I think the joke is like they can't convict a husband and wife of the same crime, and like that's what they think it is. So, what is spousal privilege? you would love Arrested Development. You haven't watched it, but there's the Fonz plays a really terrible family attorney for them.
Henry Winkler, right?
It is. You would love cool. it. Yes, you would love it. But anyway, what's to David Dial's question? What actually is spousal privilege?
So we have talked about privileges generally, right? And so the model that you would start. So, for example, by contrast, executive privilege we talked about is a deliberative process privilege, right? You keep things quiet, you fail to disclose them so that the president knows, or others with any kind of deliberative process privilege can engage in free and fair discussion, and their advisors will give them full counsel without having to run the risk that that will ever become public. But the more common form of privilege that people think about are communications-based privileges, right? And that is the classic ones are attorney-client, priest-penitent, and doctor-patient, right? And what that means is when you have a communicative privilege, then the things you tell to another person, that person is prohibited by law from revealing those things. And so the spousal privilege is a kind of communicative privilege. And it says that when you engage in communications with your spouse under which there is an expectation of privacy that fit all of the other criteria for the privilege attesting, then no third party can invade that privilege, right? Can require one spouse to give testimony against the other spouse, right? Now, what kind of...
Now, can they voluntarily do it?
Right. They can.
Okay.
So...
Because a second ago, the reason I asked is a second ago, it sounded like you said they can't do it, and then you changed... The second wording sounded more like they can't be made to do it.
Yeah.
So I wasn't sure.
You can waive the privilege, right? And so the right. classic okay. way in which you waive the privilege is... Right. Divorce proceedings. Right. When spouse sues the other, or, you know, they're otherwise, you know, on opposite sides of the table, then, you know, the privilege no longer applies. But
now let's say question, because someone actually recovering gringo here had a follow up to this involving mm-hmm. divorce. So you're saying at any time a spouse can decide to waive it. At any time they're like, well, I'm just going to testify against my husband or wife because I'm going to, whatever. But if they're divorced, now are they still protected for the time when they were married? So like, are they able to say, no, I don't want to do this. You can't make me testify about a time period when they were married, or does that allow them to testify about any time period?
That's a great question. Who did you say asked that one?
The recovering gringo. I modified it a little bit.
Recovering gringo. But, yeah. Good on you to recover from that. But no, great question. The privilege applies through the period. It covers the communications that were privileged at the time and survives even if the parties later get divorced. There is even, I believe, and again, remember, this isn't my area, but I'm pretty confident that that there was a case that I dimly remember from law school in which the privilege applies after one of the spouses is dead, right? So when you're, you know, in terms of producing documents to say, no, like that was a note that I gave, I think it was a love letter or something, right? Like, and they were trying to compel the production of document, and the husband successfully invoked spousal privilege to keep the document out.
Okay.
So it's a strong privilege. Other things that do break the privilege are if there's a third party in the room. Right. So, you know, one of the things people sometimes don't know is they think, oh, you know, you'll see this on bad cop shows. Like, I'm going to have my lawyer in the room and that's going to make everything anybody says privileged. It's actually the opposite of that. Right. Like unless it's a joint representation.
Literally the exact opposite of what you're trying to do.
Unless it's a joint representation, what that means is you've now said even the legitimate stuff, right? If you and I are talking about things and you say, oh, hey, and I want to have, you know, these five people come in the room and hang out, then like now, even when you ask me a legitimate attorney-client privileged question, the answer I give you is not going to be privileged because the presence of third parties while I give it to you vitiates the privilege.
But a clarification on that is, does that mean simply that the other people can testify about it? Or does that mean just because they were in the room, you now can make the spouse testify?
Yeah, it means I can testify about it. That's exactly right. Like, yeah, it means the spouse can be compelled. Yeah, it breaks the privilege, whether it's...
Just because someone else is in the room. Wow. Now, is there going to be something where they have to know someone was in the room? Is there a reasonable expectation of privacy kind of thing?
Okay. If there's somebody hiding under the bed, like that does not...
Right. Okay. So, wow. Interesting stuff. Yeah. Maybe I could find on YouTube a compilation of all of Barry Zuckerkorn, the Fonz in Arrested Development, of all his lawyer bits. You would really get a kick out of it. It's hilarious. But that answers that question that he had. So here's another one that's got a lot of favorites on it. This is something you've touched on before a little bit, but I think we can do maybe a recap also. Because it has a ton of favorites, so I want a ton of hearts on Patreon, which is good. If you're ever on these threads, heart the questions you want to hear, because that'll increase the chances that we ask them. What is the legal definition of a religion, and how do courts decide which beliefs are or aren't religious? Can I create the Church of Can't Drive 55 and claim sincerely held religious beliefs for speeding?
So while I wholeheartedly endorse and would join the Church of Sammy Hagar, no, you can't. It's an interesting question because there is no clear-cut definition in the case law. But what the Supreme Court has set forth is a test that says we are not going to look into the nature of religious beliefs, but we are going to check to see that they are sincerely held religious beliefs. And so that's what would be fatal to the Church of Sammy Hagar. It would be really, really easy to produce enough circumstantial evidence to prove that you don't believe that there is a magic man in the sky who gets mad at you when you slow down to 55 and who, you know, cranks 80s, you know, pop all the time. But that you are in fact, espousing those as if they were a religious belief as cover for, not wanting to obey the speed limit.
So that would be the first place of attack there. But what about, I mean, there are got to be countless examples of religious zealots who actually do believe things that are, you know, counter to all of our laws, that there must be a way that, you know, that you would attack that, right? Is there some sort of reasonability test?
There is not a reasonability test of what the belief requires. The answer is still no, that the Supreme Court is not going to look into what the belief requires, but rather remember that what RFRA did was replace the Scalia standard for free exercise clause violations set forth in Employment Division versus Smith with the earlier standard that was set forth by the court in the 1970s in Wisconsin v. Yoder. And let me do sort of briefly what that means. Employment Division versus Smith was the peyote case in which Scalia said, as a constitutional matter, the free exercise clause is not implicated if you have a neutral statute of general applicability, even if it burdens, has an incidental effect on the exercise of your religious beliefs. Now, Scalia didn't mean that because one of the general laws of, you know, neutral laws of general applicability is we don't allow strange men to serve alcohol to 14-year-old girls. And yet the Catholic Church does that every single week. Right. Scalia wasn't thinking of that. He was, of course, thinking about, you know, laws against sacrificing chickens or laws against letting people smoke peyote or, you know, other things like that. But go through, you eat peyote, right? I still don't know what you do with peyote, but whatever.
Whatever. So, whatever you're
some
doing
kind
with
of
kids.
The hep cats these days are consuming the peyote. So that basically...
We're too busy podcasting for all that.
So under the Employment Division versus Smith standard, you would say, I belong to the church of I can't drive 55. Even if the court determined that that was a sincerely held religious belief, the court would say, yeah, you know what? That's great and all, but the law requiring you to drive 55 is a neutral law of general applicability. And so you got to drive 55, even if it interferes with your religious beliefs. Going back to the Wisconsin v. Yoder standard says that, and this involved the Amish, and parents were pulling Amish kids out of school at 14 instead of 16 so that they could work on their Amish farms, right? And the Supreme Court said that in order to respect the free exercise beliefs of the Amish, that those laws, you should read in a reasonable accommodation to respect the religious practices of a group. So by replacing the standard set forth in Employment Division versus Smith with the older Wisconsin v. Yoder standard, essentially what that does is requires in states that have RFRA laws and as a matter of federal law, requires that laws provide for a reasonable accommodation for the religious beliefs of individuals. But I would point out that that's bracketed. And so, right, like that's not a super clear test. It is bracketed by a number of practical concerns. We've talked about this previously. In the early 1980s, I think it was the Jehovah's Witnesses filed a lawsuit and said, well, you know, obviously we can't, none of our members can pay taxes at all. That just conflicts with our deeply held religious beliefs. And the Supreme Court, so this was pre-Employment Division versus Smith. So this would be applicable in interpreting RFRA cases. The Supreme Court said, you know what, like, even if that's true, and even if it is a reasonable, like, then I'm sorry, but there's no way to provide you with a reasonable accommodation to the income tax law that is going to respect your religious belief. So sorry, we tried our best, but if this burdens your religious belief, there's no way for us to respect it consistent with still, you know, not immediately having a nation of 300 million Jehovah's Witnesses tomorrow, which would obviously be the result, right? Like, I mean, you know, if being a Jehovah's Witness meant no taxes applied to you, then, you know.
Boy, that's a shame, too, because there's only those 144,000 slots in heaven for Jehovah's Witnesses. So that would be too many. All right. Interesting stuff. I've got a good one from Maxwell Ooh. Demonic, the Patreon name there. Is it possible for the discovery phase of a civil suit to uncover evidence that results in the filing of criminal complaints? I would think that's got to be a yes, right?
Yes is the answer to that.
How would that go about? Like, who, you know, is there some duty to report this stuff if you're an attorney and it, you know, is during the discovery? What goes on there, and how does it happen?
A number of things, right? So number one, most discovery is public. Unless it is subject to a protective order, that the stuff that you uncover is open and available to the public. Number two, obviously, the individuals can report. I will tell you that in situations where there is considerable ambiguity, the police are often very, very reluctant to get involved when one party in civil litigation wants to bring criminal charges against another for the obvious reasons, right? Like, they don't want their process to be viewed as a political football. I want to tell a real life story here. I represented a business that had four partners, each with a 25% share, and they were two married couples, and they were cousins, and there was considerable acrimony when it was discovered that two of the cousins were stealing business from the rest of the business. They were diverting customers to, oh, did you hear about our satellite office? And the satellite office was a competing business, the cousins at Opera. And then, right, you know, there was sorts of terrible stuff. And then as the litigation went on, the other side began escalating in ways that would have been comical if it were not proceeding against my client, right? Like, they did things like filed a fraudulent claim to divert the mail to somebody else's house. And then they stole, they had a copy of the key to one of the vans made, and they stole the van on Christmas. And ultimately they hired, I'm not making this up, they hired an elderly member of the Russian mafia to shoot my client, who came up but because he was so old, he had spastic hand issues and shot my client in the leg instead at point blank range. So, and I went to the Baltimore police.
How have you never told this story before? What episode are we on? How is it for this many episodes? This would have been, I would have
great stories. So I went to the Baltimore police. I went to the Economic Crimes Division, and I said, hey, you know, one of the cousins filed a domestic ex parte protective order in Baltimore. I think this is true throughout Maryland, but it's definitely true in Baltimore City. A woman who is the victim of domestic violence can swear out an ex parte protective order, in which an ex parte means only the one side, right? So she doesn't have to let the other side know. So it's designed to protect battered women who need to be secure in their homes. You can run down to the court. You can swear out an ex parte protective order. You say, you know, Thomas Smith is physically abusing me and I fear for my life.
Sure.
And the court will issue on solely your say so, without any warning or notice for you, Thomas Smith, to be heard, a 14-day order that says, okay, Thomas Smith cannot come within 100 feet of, you know, this woman for 14 days. And the reason that they strike that balance is because we've decided, you know, yes, there's some potential for abuse, which I'm about to describe, but by and large, we think protecting women is worth striking the balance in that direction.
And the MRA is asking, and only women can do this? Or is you allowed, what if you're the husband? Can a husband do this?
I believe, and again, it's been 15 years since I did this case and not my area, but I believe it is gender neutral, right? It is, I'm describing the situation in which it is meant to apply, but it is stated in, I believe, gender neutral terms. I could be wrong on that, but that's my recollection.
Well, I'd be curious if that, if you'd be allowed to do that.
But this was, one of the cousins was a woman, and she swore that my client was beating her up in the office. So my client was then unable to show up at the office for 2 weeks pending this hearing because of the doc. So, I thought it was, it was pretty obvious that, that there were a lot of shenanigans going on. But the bottom line was I took it to the Economic Crimes Division and they said, your client's suing these guys. Yeah, we don't take that. We don't take cases where there's an open civil suit between the parties. So I don't know to what extent that is common practice, but I know it's certainly
stymied. What about the hiring a hitman?
Yeah, no, we swore out a police report, but as far as I know, that crime was never investigated or prosecuted. Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
How? A guy got shot.
Yeah, he did. But he never, my knowledge is.
So did he not press charges or something? That was the problem?
Up, right. My knowledge is again, because this is my client. So, he was never called to testify. And, you would think that would be a rather important element of, trying to figure out, trying to prove a criminal case against someone. So.
I think the question, what was it? Was it, is the criminal justice system broken? I think the answer is yes.
Yes, that answer is yes.
There is no law, apparently. Wow, that is weird. Here's on a lighter note, Jacob Davis asks, Andrew, are you constantly covered in corgi fur? If not, how?
Yeah, I was mistakenly told by the person who convinced me to get a corgi that corgis blow their coats twice a year, and that's it. And I will tell you, if by twice a year you mean all the time, then yes, corgis blow their coats. My puppy, but twice a year, and actually it's more like 4 or 5 times a year, when she blows her coat, like my puppy leaves like a slightly smaller little puppy amount of fur behind, right? Like it is, you could truly make, a fur snowman out of the like quantities of fur that are left around. So yes, I am covered in corgi fur all the time.
Question answered. There you go. That was a simpler one. It was a little lighter note than is the justice system a failure. John Bodley asks,
Esquire.
We always hear about John Bodley Esquire. We always hear about the bar exam. What is the bar and why is it called that?
I don't know the answer to that. I don't.
Are you kidding? I thought this was a freebie.
You'd think
for
it'd be
you.
A freebie? Obviously, the bar is what you call an attorney who is admitted to practice. I am sure that it has its roots in like 13th century Anglo-Saxon. Like there was some, wooden bar that stood in between. But I don't know. I don't know. Maybe they might have even done that in one of my law school classes, but I probably was out sick that day or something. So don't know the answer to it. Great, great question. I'm going to look it up when we're off the air, but I don't want to cheat and look it up and give you a great historical answer right now. So look for that in a future episode of Opening Arguments, because I'd like to figure it out. You do get, I am familiar with literally every joke. Like when I had just passed the bar exam when I wrote my first book, which was a statistical, kind of a pre-Moneyball book, but not nearly as good as Moneyball, which is the proof is because, Michael Lewis is optioning screenplays and I'm still doing this podcast, but I did a whole bunch of radio interviews. And when you do like sports talk radio interviews and, and so I just passed the bar as part of your banter, like you realize every one of these, like, Joe and Joe in the morning on KTWV thinks, well, see, that's the difference between you and me. I never pass up a bar is that they're the first one to make that crack. And every time I kind of had to dutifully look up, you got me on that one, Joe.
Well, I never thought of that one. Wow.
I guess what I'm saying is interviews tend to get repetitive. I wish I had an answer for you, but this is.
Yeah, I'm just so stunned that you don't have an answer. Because I thought you mentioned something about it at one point, but I must have imagined it. But
maybe if I passed a bar now and then I would remember, but.
Damian Rickard asks, why are driver's licenses recognized in every state, but pistol permits are not? One is a constitutional right.
Okay, so I think I dispute every part of that question. So First, we have, if you go back to our Second Amendment deep dive, it's in the 20s. I strongly dispute that the notion of an individual right to keep and bear arms is protected in the Constitution. Don't think it is, and I don't think anybody seriously argued that it was until the late 1980s. And even then, that movement didn't get beyond the fringes until the past 15 years or so.
Until it became the mainstream of our country.
Antonin Scalia declared by fiat that it was what the founding fathers intended. Yeah. So, number two, not all driver's licenses are equally accepted sort of as forms of identification. In fact, you might even notice this at the airport, that there are federal homeland security standards for what constitute an approved identification. And there are three or four states whose licenses do not meet those standards. And I believe they're designed to be for counterfeiting purposes, right? Like, you know, they're sort of easier to fake in those states. And so the Homeland Security has announced that they will not accept as valid identification driver's licenses from those states.
Right.
In general, we try to have uniformity of standards across states, but there are situations where, you know, one state may not give the operative constitutional phrase when it comes to states recognizing the federal government is the full faith and credit clause of the Constitution, right? Like that federal determinations are to be given, you know, full faith and credit in any state in the United States. And there is a fair amount of overlap, but there's also a fair amount of states can decide what they want to do.
Yeah. When it comes to the states coordinating on stuff like that, it sounds pretty informal, right? Just sounds like there's no requirement that they all have certain standards for certain things. It's just they want to out of convenience, or because your citizens will be pissed if your driver's licenses are useless in other states.
Let me parse that distinction a little more clearly.
Okay.
If you are talking about legal determinations, right, judicial proceedings are what I know among states are required, fall under the full faith and credit clause, right? So in other words, Alabama cannot say, oh yeah, well, that was a Maryland court that came up with, you know, that ruled X, and, you know, we all know they're crazy up there in Maryland, so we're not going to recognize this judgment that was entered by a Maryland court. Okay, so when it comes to judicial proceedings, those are constitutionally required to be honored across state lines. But as far as I know, it is just judicial proceedings, you know, acts of the state legislature. You know, so if the government says, you know, if the state government makes a particular determination, that's another, you know, that's not optional. But everything else is optional.
Interesting. All right. Matt Hanley asks, you mentioned on a previous episode that adultery was still on the books as a crime because it allows you to plead the fifth when asked about cheating on a spouse, even though no one is ever prosecuted for it. That was interesting. I remember when you mentioned that. I didn't know that. Is this just an unwritten understanding that we should leave adultery on the books for this reason, or is there a case where this came up?
I don't know of any particular case that has specifically said that, but it's just sort of, you know, kind of known in the legal community that's why adultery is still a crime in most jurisdictions.
Hmm. Interesting. I would imagine at some point there may be some people not in the know about that who want to get that off the books.
And that's why it is kind of generally known, because it's sort of journalists. One of the very common journalist stories is, you know, wacky laws that are still
weird
on the
laws
books.
That are, yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know,
you did that in your morning interview,
right,
with a, yeah, and, with the same guys who said they, right, never pass up the bar.
And, and you would think of this as one of the sort of wacky laws that are still in the books, but it serves a useful purpose. So
no case law, you know, just kind of an informal thing.
You can find case law in which, you know, individuals have, right, it would be a part of the description to say John Smith was compelled to testify, but, you know, pled the Fifth Amendment on the grounds that, you know, he would incriminate himself when asked questions about his sex life or something like that.
Hunter Ash asks, what are your personal philosophical as well as legal opinions on polygamy? Should it be legalized? Could it be? How would that work? And this one, I got a lot of people interested in, and actually said, we also got a little bit of leveraging because mediocre Mr. Micah said, this is an excellent question from a top patron. And so I think that was gee, I sure hope you won't bother investigating this. Like that was the suggestion on that level, like Trump made to Comey. No, interesting. I can just tackle part of that first, just to say that I'm of the mindset that I don't really care what consenting adults do in general. So I'm curious if Andrew will tell me there's some hidden legal or moral problem with it, but I really just don't care. So when conservatives ask what's next after gay marriage, you know, multiple marriage, whatever, I suppose I would have said, okay, I don't really, if you want to, but I'm curious if you have a different opinion.
So I certainly don't have a different philosophical opinion that, you know, when we talk about, you know, sort of polyamory more generally, I'm with you in the sense that people want consensually to do with and among and between each other is none of my business.
You know, it just, I just realized though, I was thinking this through and it's like, how would this work? I mean, would you limit it to a number? How would the tax stuff of it work? How would the practicality of all that could like 40
people
be married?
Immediately anticipated where I'm going. So I'm going to postpone going there for a second. And instead a bit of history that like now we have, you know, kind of philosophically some right now we have, I think, robust philosophical debate on what constitutes loving relationships that are sort of worthy of respect philosophically and legally. And that's great. And obviously the more that, you know, we have those discussions, I think the better off society is. It is certainly worth pointing out that historically the record of polygamy has been almost entirely uniformly awful. And it is worth looking into, you know, all of the underlying conditions which polygamist movements in this country have typically, number one, reinforced, you know, patriarchal norms. They've almost always been one man taking multiple wives due to massive power imbalances. And number two, and again, there's no reason it has to be this way, but, you know, when you think about like the FLDS church in Utah have overlapped with, you know, taking child brides and things like that. And obviously like you can decouple those issues, but I think it does. I think you have to acknowledge that those are real historical issues. And then the second aspect, as you pointed out, marriage is a way of consolidating a bundle of rights that you can otherwise parcel out via contract, some of which you can parcel out via contract, right? The preferential tax treatment, you can't. But, you know, you could, with enough work, kind of parcel out medical directives and visitation rights and property ownership and distribution and dissolution of property ownership when one person gets divorced. And all, you know, you could, with enough time and forethought and money spent on lawyers, you could write a contract that kind of covers all of those things. But what we do with marriage is say, okay, we're going to stick all of these contractual rights under a single name and let you accomplish it with a single instrument, right? Like you get a marriage license, you get recognized by the state, and all of a sudden it says, oh yeah, okay, we know what that means. Practically speaking, it would require a lot to change that bundle of rights to recognize, you know, a multi-party relationship. It could be done, but it would require, I mean, it would require sort of like science fiction standards of a change to the society because, you know, look, it's sort of the classic example of any minority is if you're such an overwhelmingly tiny minority, it's really difficult to get the majority to say, okay, well, we're going to, you know, go through this level of difficulty to, you know, to rewrite our laws and, you know, re-standardize our norms for 0.0001% of the population or what have you. And again, I'm not in no way, I mean, I'm thinking about that with respect to, you know, the current issues over, you know, the administration's assault on transgendered individuals, right? Like, that's the common refrain you hear from people is, well, I don't have anything against them, but like, you know, like I'm going to support, you know, passing a law just to protect, I don't know any transgender. And that I mention that not as a justification. I think it's well established that, you know, Thomas, that you and I are do our best to be allies of trans people.
Well, plus, I mean, there's a big difference between what you're talking about here, which is it really would be like an upheaval of a lot of different things that we I don't even know how you would structure a lot of things versus we're going to ban trans people from the military.
It may not be the best analogy,
not,
but I was just thinking that
having them
that,
in the military. Yeah. No, I'm trying to go like have that. That is not the same. Like it's. That isn't a burden. Like having trans people in the military isn't a burden on anyone. Like that's there's nothing. It's you know. So I think there's a difference.
Yeah. I just think.
But
that,
anyway, yeah,
that
interesting issue.
It's too small. Yeah. I mean, it's just a reality that like if you represent a very very small, maybe that's the way to put it. If you represent a small percentage of the population, and then you would look proportionately to see the burden that accommodation would require, and you know, if it's a small group seeking a massive accommodation, then, you know, even if it's reasonable and justified politically, the likelihood of that happening becomes very, 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 very small.
Interesting. Yeah. There wouldn't be the same arguments, I'm guessing, of like equal protection kind of stuff, because it's like, or would it be this? I'm trying to think if that would be an analogous at all.
Yeah,
I don't know.
I guess not.
Yeah.
I think you would still be able to raise the equal protection argument. But, you know, here is where I think the history would come into play. Let me answer the question this way. There is, for all of practical, legal, and historical reasons, there is no chance, in my view, that you will be able to judicially establish the right to plural marriage or, you know, other recognition of polygamy, polyamorous conditions through the judiciary. Right. Like this is something that if the change is going to come, it is going to have to come via the legislative process. Right. Like that it's just too much change in too many areas that is too disanalogous to the current structure.
All right. Here's an interesting one that I'm actually curious. I'm sure you'll have an easy answer for it, but I don't think it's anything you've ever talked about. Marcus Rademacher, hopefully I'm pronouncing that right, asks, over the years, there have been proposals to make SCOTUS appointments be fixed length terms, like 10 years, instead of the lifetime stuff. What do you think about that? And then there's others pointing out, which I was going to point out as well. One downside to that already is it being more politicized, I guess, and less independent. But what do you think about that?
So here, this is going to require a constitutional amendment because Article 3 of the Constitution says the judicial power of the United States shall be vested in one Supreme Court and in such inferior courts as Congress may from time to time ordain and establish. And then, I memorized that sentence I had memorized, but this sentence I had to look up.
Say, you just came up with
that. The judges, both of the Supreme and the inferior courts, shall hold their offices during good behavior and shall, at stated times, receive for their services a compensation which shall not be diminished during their continuance in office. So I read that very, very clearly as saying that you cannot impose term limits on length of time. That term limits is the wrong phrase, it's not the same as legislative term. But in any event, you could not change the fact that Supreme Court justices are appointed for life via legislative.
Without
it would require an amendment to the Constitution.
Well, just quickly, what do you think about, like, let's say that weren't the case, or let's say would you like that? Would you like that it would be less of a, you know, such a huge impact that it's sort of a disproportionate impact that random chance in some ways have, well, it's not entirely chance, but just when justices retire or pass away.
And especially
it's
because
such a huge swing.
Republicans have really hit the jackpot lately, right? Like Republican terms have coincided. Barack Obama was president for 8 years and got to make 2 appointments, right? Like, and so the certainly is a randomness to it. I don't want to sound hopelessly naive. I only want to sound slightly naive. But for a very long time, within my lifetime, it was not a given that Supreme Court appointees were politically motivated. It was considered, yeah. And look, this requires a commitment by both sides, right? Like, it was considered the duty of the president to appoint a qualified, a maximally qualified candidate to the Supreme Court. And it was considered the duty of the Senate in advise and consent of ferreting out individuals who were not qualified academically or who, and we've mentioned Robert Bork on the show before, were qualified academically, but who had a judicial philosophy that was outside the mainstream of American jurisprudence. And somehow after the Senate Judiciary Committee torpedoed the nomination of Robert Bork, by the way, a Republican Senate, right? Well, no, actually it was 1986.
Oh,
so,
yeah.
So Joe Biden was chair by then, but that committee got Republican support, not just Arlen Specter, I believe also Charles Mack Mathias from Maryland. It multiple Republicans supported the notion that Robert Bork was too radical, too political to serve on the Supreme Court of the United States. And, you know, do I see necessarily a path there now? It's kind of tough, but yeah, I mean, that was the argument that you and I made in the 6 weeks leading up to Gorsuch being appointed to the Supreme Court was not that this guy wasn't, you know, plenty Harvard, you know, appellate court smart, but that he was very obviously politically motivated, and it used to be good enough to be a disqualifier, and I wish it was again.
So that would be something to fix before the constitutional amendment, yeah, essentially.
That's my view.
Yeah. Although both might be equally impossible. that makes sense.
If I can do a slight aside, I just heard, mm-hmm. this was a Penn Jillette comment that he made on his show that I don't, there's a lot about Penn. I mean, he's a libertarian. There's a lot politically I don't agree with, but one of his sort of, you know, silver linings about Donald Trump as a takeaway that I thought is worth sharing was, well, the one thing we definitely know for sure now doesn't exist is the thing that Fox News keeps saying does exist, right? Like this concept of the deep state, right? Like it was prior to Donald Trump, you could maybe have held this view in the back of your mind that, like, you know, there's the secret cabal of the CIA and the FBI that really runs things. And it doesn't matter who you vote in, that, like, you know, these same, you know, deep state officials kind of make it happen and, you know, strong arm the president into going in line and, you know, that sort of, and you know, we heard that sort of stuff, you know, over the past elections, right? It doesn't matter who you are. It's clear that apparatus doesn't exist, right? Because if that apparatus existed, they would have grabbed control of Donald Trump by now, you know?
Yeah.
And I thought that was, an interesting perspective. I'm always looking for reasons not to despair about the presidency. There are not a lot of them, but I think kind of conclusively proving, like, no, this, you really are electing a president. Elections really do have consequences. They, you know, really do make their decisions, you know, for good or for ill, you know, sort of subject to all of the political constraints that we see, but that there isn't, you know, there isn't an Illuminati pulling the strings. Like, if there is, right, the Illuminati has less power than, you know, my local chamber of commerce, right? Like, but so I thought that was interesting anyway.
Illuminati never can decide when to be all knowing and powerful. I get this one's funny. Gerardo Garcia asks, Andrew, completely off the rails question. You've got a fancy last name, Torres. Do you mind saying something about your background? Feel free not to answer, of course. Just want to know if we are secret cousins or something.
I am perfectly happy to answer that question, which is, I have Hispanic, Mexican relatives on my dad's side of the family. And that heritage has been passed down. There was a fun story involving, I believe my grandfather, I could be getting this wrong because this was told to me as a child, but,
fact check you
when emigrating, changing the traditional Spanish spelling of the last name from T-O-R-R-E-S to T-O-R-R-E-Z to reflect how it's actually pronounced, right? Like if you see a Torres in Spanish, it's spelled with an S, but pronounced like a Z. I didn't realize that the next million Torreses after him were not going to so change their last name. And then my dad was adopted. So that's how, because the real question there is you have this great last name and Hispanic heritage, which is all true, but you kind of look like a pasty white guy. What's up with that? And that's what's up with that. So that was the real question.
Okay. Yeah. No, sorry. I didn't see that at first.
No, but my dad is a patron of the show. So hopefully he's hearing this Q&A. He's listening. I think I'm his second favorite podcast now. So we're working on it.
Well, you know, that's a great segue to this next question by Steve Caplet.
Another patron.
If that's pronounced correctly. What podcasts do the hosts listen to on a regular basis? This has like maybe the most hearts of all the questions, so I'm glad I'm getting to this. I can start us off because Andrew always talks. Ever since the election, I kind of shifted. I was listening to more, you know, I would listen to comedy stuff. I would listen to whatever, but especially when I was working full time too at the state, I had time to kind of, and you know, I'd want some lighthearted stuff while I'm doing spreadsheet work or programming work or something. And since Trump and this being my full-time job, I'm like soloing on just info, news, political analysis kind of stuff. So I love The Daily. That's one I would definitely recommend, the New York Times Daily podcast. It's only 15, 20, 25 minutes max a day. And it's usually one or two stories. And it's really good. I like it quite a bit. And I also listen to the Vox podcasts. I listen to probably my favorite would be I really like Pod Save America, just because we get a lot, and Pod Save the World, which are both the same family, which is the people. It's Jon Favreau, John Lovett, and some other guys that worked in the Obama administration. They started a podcast empire after that. And it's really interesting getting insight into just how smart a lot of these people are. And especially when you talk, when you listen to the foreign policy one, which is Pod Save the World, that's focused on foreign policy. And you hear just how intelligent and deeply these people were thinking about issues. And then you can contrast that to what's happening now. And it's incredibly depressing, but it has been fascinating to get that inside look. I'd be remiss if I didn't mention my favorite comedy podcasts, which are of course Cognitive Dissonance, Scathing Atheist, God Awful Movies, all those guys. Those are great. When I want to laugh, those are my go-tos, but I definitely focus on more news stuff lately.
Yeah. I think I endorse all of those. A couple of sort of smaller podcasts that are friends of ours that I'd like to give some love out to. I've reached out on Twitter and have recommended friend Jody Hume and another lawyer, Elliot Wagenheim, do a business podcast called So Here's My Story. That what they do is they even have this like an anonymize. It's like the Optimus Prime voice mask to like, you know, anonymize you. But they get CEOs and other business people to like tell an illustrative story. And one of them was like about at this, in fact, that the intro episode is about telling the story about, so I peed my pants this time. I do a lot of, you know, business consulting kind of stuff. And most of my clients are entrepreneurs, and most business stuff, it's just dreadful. and it's a good show. I love what they're doing. We have had my buddy, Chris Christofko, a childhood friend of mine, who does Titletown Sound, which is a Green Bay Packers podcast. But if you like pro football, I mean, I know it's very cool to be like anti sports ball in our community, but you won't find that on this show. You and I both like football, but I suspect a large percentage of our audience doesn't. But if you like football and particularly, you know, you play fantasy football or whatever, give them a listen. Our patron, our friend Sharon does Habeas Humor, which is it's a good right. show. She does real. It's called Habeas Humor, but she's kind of selling herself short. She does some good in-depth stories too. She did one recently on it was a kind of a follow-up to what we did on the fact that there's no standard legal definition of what constitutes reasonable doubt. And it was pretty good.
It is true there are too many good podcasts out there. There's actually too many. People should cut back on how many good podcasts they
make. Listen to this one
first, just because I don't get to listen to, the ones they're making, because I don't get time to listen to all of them, and I feel like I am left out of so many great ones. There are a ton of great podcasts. I don't even think I scratched the surface of my list of podcasts.
Look, I mean, I could be here all day. I mean, I said earlier in this episode, right? I listened to Penn's podcast, right? But like, you don't need me to say that. Like, I've listened to Serial and I listened to Radiolab. Like, that. I mean, those get Sam Harris's podcast, right? Like, they get a billion downloads a month. I was trying to pick a few that are, maybe not as well known. But I think it's safe to say Thomas and I like love podcasts. We love this medium. And we listen to a ton of them.
Yeah, there are so many good ones. So sorry, I didn't mean to leave anybody out. I think there are a ton we could mention, and they're really good. So we'll be here all day listing them. So let's get on to John Bodley's question. Oh, wait, I think he already asked one, but this one has a lot of hearts, so I think we got to ask it. The Fifth Amendment says, no person shall be subject, except in case of impeachment, to more than one punishment or trial for the same offense, nor shall be compelled to witness against himself, nor be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor be obliged to relinquish his property where it may be necessary for public use. End quote. Why doesn't the Fifth Amendment protect us from civil forfeiture, the civil asset forfeiture? I'm guessing they would just say that is due process, right? There is some sort of due process there, or am I wrong?
Yes and no. So maybe not even yes and no. Maybe yes and there's more to that. Ooh. So number one.
Oh, okay. I'm happy if you're going to feel free to tell me no and no. I'm happy to be wrong, but there was nothing
about that you said that was incorrect. There is just a bit more that we would expand to that. We are planning to do, it's on the whiteboard, but again, Donald Trump has got to take a break or something from being horrible for a couple of weeks for us to...
I'm guessing that's not going to decrease
the amount of horrible things that are happening, right? Because it's not just him, right?
It's a good guess.
There's an instrumentality of horrible things that has been set in motion. One of the things that I want to talk about is that last part of the Fifth Amendment, which is called the Takings Clause. You saw a little bit of this come up in the Republican primary debates over the notion of eminent domain. And there was a very controversial decision called Kelo versus City of New London. And that decision, I should take a step back. The power of eminent domain is the power of the government to take private property for public use, so long as they pay you the fair market value of the property that they have taken. That was then applied in Kelo versus City of New London, where a local government seized private property and then sold that property to developers in a public-private partnership, right? And so it's really created kind of this very interesting clash between, on the one hand, kind of the far left, sort of socialist, anti-capitalist left, with the far right libertarian pro-property rights on one side, and then the neoliberal free market public private partnerships and pro-big business Republicans aligned on the other side. So it's a really interesting political question. I really want to delve into that notion of eminent domain, and we will. I just can't promise you when.
But
there's another aspect, which is the threshold question of what constitutes a taking, okay? Because, right, I mean, there are two sub-clauses to this clause, right? The first is that the government can't take your property without just compensation, right? So they can compensate you for it so long as it's an appropriate taking of your property. But also, it is no taking at all if they don't actually take the property. And so then the question becomes, what does it mean to take the property? And so let me give you an example of what it doesn't mean. Okay. I have a store is an actual real case near my old house. There was a store called the Red Door Country Store, and it had been standing. It had a big red door on the front of it, and it was a general store in Montgomery County that was at the major crossroads of what were then the two largest roads running through that area of the county. There was a lot of farmland, and, you know, right at that crossroad, great place to have a general store. By the time I had moved there, construction was underway and was soon completed of a massive highway called the Intercounty Connector, which intersected that road a mile to the west and thereby reduced the traffic on the two roads in front of the Red Door Store from considerable to zero. Okay. And so this general goods store very quickly went out of business. Now, it is not a hard argument to say, but for the government moving the road, right? And you can think of all sorts of things, right? Like, I have a house with a beautiful, you know, lakefront view, but I don't own the next parcel over, which is just an empty field. Somebody buys that field and puts up a 50-story skyscraper, right? And now, instead of having a beautiful view of the lake, I have a terrible view of this big, ugly building, right? That drastically reduces the commercial value of my building. So all of these things that we think of where the government, where it's not hard, you know, suppose the government turns all the roads out in front of my house to one way, the other way, right? Like, there are lots of things the government could do that would drastically reduce the value of your building. But in order to qualify as a taking, they have to either A, eliminate all or substantially all economic use of the property, B, deprive you physically of the property, or C, deprive you of such a character of the bundle of rights associated with your property as to, quote, constructively qualify as a taking. And, you know, and sort of the interesting thing there is what that means is, you know, the government can require you to, you know, grant an easement on your property for underground pipes and wires and stuff like that. But if they physically, and that can require them, you know, tearing up the street in front of your house for 2 years and you get nothing, you get zero compensation out of that. It's not a taking. But if they stick a box on your property, right, they have to pay you. Even if the box is just, you know, 1 square foot, they've got to pay you for physically taking that 1 square foot of your property. And again, the fair market value of that 1 square foot of your property is probably very, very little. But they actually have to pay you for that if they physically take it, even if the physical taking is really small. And they don't have to pay you for diminishing the value of your property, even if the diminution has a much greater economic impact than the physical taking. And again, this is because, as we've said before, like, property law is this horrible patchwork that's left over from the 13th century Anglo-Saxons and makes no sense. But the idea was somehow, you know, physical taking was more serious than depriving you of the rest of your bundle of property rights, where, you know, I don't think anybody left or right would think that that's the case today. But nevertheless, that's how the law is. So lots of great stuff. I'm really glad the question got asked. I really can't wait to do an episode on it.
Specifically on civil asset forfeiture, or specifically on eminent domain.
So, right. Sorry, thanks for reminding.
The question was about civil asset forfeiture.
that I didn't. So the civil asset forfeiture, the two answers to that are going to be, number one, that there's due process attached to it, and number two, in some cases, that, you know, it may not be a physical taking if it's things like, you know, freezing bank accounts or whatever. I mean, obviously, when they take your car, you know, when they proceed against the pile of cash in the back seat, they have physically taken it. But there may also be an argument that
But there's, when they do that, they're saying there's some sort of due process, and that's how they're able to get away with it. What about? I just want to ask a quick one. What about when you see in the movies when a police officer needs your car? Are they allowed to do that? Is that real or is that made up?
I think that's made up.
What do they call? Now I'm blanking. What do they call it? I need to something.
Yeah, I got to commandeer your vehicle. Movie. But yeah.
Commandeer, yeah. I think commandeer
the,
vehicle.
The best one of that is the car chase scene in Fletch, which is outstanding.
Fletch is your go-to. I'm going to have to... I've seen it a million years ago, but it sounds like I'll just have to watch it more so that we can have a better relationship. Yeah. So that's made up. So if a police officer tells me I need to accommodate
people... Remember, one of the iron rules of this show, we do not dispense advice about what to deal with, you know, what to do with police officers.
I was going to say, I'm still going to do it because it's a police officer. And I don't want to get shot because they have a gun and I don't. But yeah, but they may, but I may have a case against them later.
Yes.
So we'll see. All right. And with that, we are out of time. We plenty more to get to. But, you know, that's why the show will have to continue perpetually throughout the entire universe. That's why we'll have to keep doing it, because there are always more questions for one Andrew Torres Esquire. And thank you so much for the participation on Patreon. Hope you enjoyed this. And we'll have to say, if you want to be able to ask one of these questions, you got to jump on patreon.com/law. But that's okay if you can't. You still get to enjoy the content.
Thank you very much.
All right, Andrew, because we are currently away, and we don't have a new patron thanks for this week. But you know what? Andrew had a great idea, which is an old patron thanks. And not old as in, you know, like Andrew is old. Not old like that. Andrew, old as in who were our first patrons. So we're going to thank our patrons who have been here from the very beginning, who pledged within like a week of when we started, just to give you that extra recognition, because you're so great. Seriously, you've been there from the beginning and we can't thank you enough. And those people are Dan Irizarry, the Zika baby that lived, Rob Ives, Eli Bosnick, David in Kentucky, Lindsay Osterman, John Brady, Dave Nichols of Positively Doubtful Podcast, The Flying Skeptic, Harley, Simon Tanner, James Hamblin, John, Brandon Willis, and Travis Saul.
Yeah, and thank you to Aaron M. Gleason, Jared Teets, Buck Buckholz. Oh, great. That's a great name. Brian Dunham, Michael Ford, Reverend Jesus H. Christ, Paul Andrew Waddington, Jack, Frank Ferriello, Jonathan Floucher, Stan Pollock, Steve Sigmund, Stephen Dymek, Deadeye Nick, Scott Billis, Cindy Lynch. She's been there since the very beginning. Jim Grove, Ted Meadows, Cohen De Bruin, Tiglath Pilzer III. I definitely don't remember reading that, so you get
probably
that reader
did.
Now.
Yeah.
Kaylee Reiser, Farhan Salas, Carl, Samir Abdallah, the Honorable Roger Metcalf, best patron in the universe, one of the longest standing patrons in the universe.
Yeah.
Jonathan, Eric Ripley, Alexandra Tursky, Ryan Fedewa, Scott, David Dial, Derek Timp, Richard Still, and Graham Baradoy. And again, these are the folks who have been with us since our first week, including our very first patron, Danny Rosari, first person in the door, and are still patrons today at any level. So we appreciate your longstanding patronage.
It's been a year.
Thanks.
It's been a year, guys. Thank you. You've been supporting us for a year. We can't thank you enough. That's really cool. Hope you're enjoying the show still.
Anniversary Patron
Tuesday. Yeah, this is what we got you for your anniversary.
It is. Your first anniversary is the paper anniversary, and this is kind of the equivalent,
there we go.
Of that, right? So, anyway, we couldn't mean this more sincerely. Thank you so much for being with us from the beginning and still supporting us today.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
All right, Andrew, it is time for what is still currently one of my favorite segments of this show, and that is Thomas Nails the Bar Exam. I think I'm 20 for 37. Could that be right?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes, it is correct.
I have got breathing
20
room.
20 for 37.
Wow. I am. That is points above 50%. So let's find out if my improbable streak has continued. This was a tricky question. I don't know.
Yeah, this question tested your knowledge, which I know is extensive, of prior consistent statements. Those, keep in mind, the really tricky thing that this question did not tell you is you are analyzing these statements under the hearsay rule, right? As we are introducing them, they are out of court declarations made by somebody other than the person who's being cross-examined.
Wait, what?
That's how they have to come in.
Oh, right? It's not just statements. I thought it was just statements by the witness
When you bring up prior inconsistent statements, you are saying, isn't it true, you know, Mr. Smith, that on August 13th, 2016, you said X, Right. So in other words, it's not his testimony there. It's an out of court statement that you are bringing up for the purpose of impeachment.
So when your testimony ends up just being the thing you decide, like you've collected your thoughts. I see. So it is hearsay, even though it's not really. This could be. All right. This was a tough one. Let's find out.
It sure was. So let's start off with Thomas's second chance bar exam. You eliminated no because it would tend to confuse the jury with too much conflicting evidence. That was answer B. That's a good elimination.
Right.
Remember that the baseline principles of the federal rules of evidence are that evidence is admissible. Evidence begins with the premise that any fact that has any tendency to make any material fact more or less certain.
Yeah.
And then you build exceptions around that. So the idea that there's sort of a baseline rule of it's too confusing to bring in too much evidence, that's not the way our system works. Right. So good elimination there. You also eliminated D, yes, because all repetitive prior statements are important to show the consistency of the witness's testimony. Not true. Repetitive prior statements are presumptively inadmissible because they're hearsay and because
like
they're
it
not,
said in the question. Sorry? Like it said in the question, prior consistent statement. Okay, I trusted the question. I'm glad I did. Sounds like it was
good. Good. And that's another important thing. I don't typically see this. It's a weird formulation for the bar question. But it's something I see in essays a lot. It was certainly the case in my essay, is that oftentimes the question itself will give you legal information and you are allowed to take that information at face value.
Yeah, they're not
if it's established in the question,
right?
If
it says not gonna try to
there's
trick
a
you.
Statute that prohibits X, there's a statute that prohibits X. And, well, and you can answer
there you
the
go.
Question.
Second chance bar exam is like 99%.
Yep. So B and D, both good eliminations. You chose between A and C. A was no, because the witness cannot be rehabilitated once a successful impeachment has occurred. You eliminated that answer. And I need to tell you, that's a good elimination.
Woo!
And the reason is because there's no such thing as a successful impeachment.
Wait, it doesn't fall like under Article whatever, the Constitution that talks about impeaching things.
Yeah. Impeachment here in the witness context means casting doubt on the credibility of the witness.
Not an official procedure. There wasn't a Senate vote on this witness.
The House doesn't have to. Right. It is just about when you say you've impeached someone as a witness on the stand, that is your assessment of, you know, I've shown that the witness has made inconsistent statements. And we've talked about the classic way in which that happens, right? Which is to say, in your deposition, you say, no, the fence was always 3 feet from the property line. And then at trial, you say, well, the fence was 1 foot in 1987. And then I put up on the screen, Mr. Smith, do you recall when I took your deposition 6 months ago and I asked you the same question and I said, was the fence ever closer than 3 feet? And you said, can you read that answer up there? And you say, no, it was only, you know, it was always 3 feet away from the property line. And then I say, well, Mr. Smith, you just testified in 1987. It was 1 foot from
and
the property
really
line.
And you really milk it because you're a jerk of a.
Yeah.
Attorney.
So
really
which
just,
is it? Were you lying in your deposition or are you lying
it?
Now?
Yeah, you got to really go over the top. Mr. Smith, could you read? That's how you have to do it.
Yes. if you can do it in an Edith Bunker voice, it's even better. But no, like, so that's classic impeachment, but there's no judicial determination that a successful impeachment has occurred. So you are left with answer C, which you picked, which is correct. And that reflects the words of Rule 801D of the Federal Rules of Evidence, which says that a prior consistent statement is admissible only if it is offered, one, to rebut an express or implied charge that the declarant recently fabricated it or acted from an improper influence or motive in testifying, or two, to rehabilitate the declarant's credibility as a witness when attacked on another ground. And you can imagine that. Take the same impeachment that I just did with the 3 foot, 1 foot. Suppose 35 times you said, it's 3 feet away. It's 3 feet away. Mm-hmm. It's 3 feet away. It's 3 feet away. And once you were like, yeah, no, it's 1 foot. I'm sorry. I mean, it's 3 feet away. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah, that's what I was figuring.
Yeah, that's how you rehabilitate. You say, look, you know,
one
Thomas
time
was being badgered.
My blood sugar was low. I had a real jerk of somebody named Andrew Torres just cross-examining me or whatever, deposing.
That Torres cross-examination was ridiculous.
Everyone withers under the screw, the intensity of the Torres cross-examination.
Something like that. But yeah, so that's how you go about rehabilitation, and that's where prior consistent statements can come in. Even though they're hearsay, it's a very, very narrow exception to the hearsay rules, and you manage to successfully navigate that minefield. You are 6 in a row and 21 of 38.
Do you believe in miracles? Of all the Cinderella stories to ever happen, either these questions are getting easier or I'm getting better at this or both. It might be both.
I think you're getting smarter. Yeah, I think that's the only conclusion that we can
Listen to the podcast Opening Arguments with one Andrew Torres. It's been very
helpful. How could you be better prepared for the bar
you
exam
can't,
than
exactly.
That?
Exactly. All right. Well, this week we've got a lucky winner. And for patrons, you might be hearing this early. We don't have it yet. Sorry, patrons. But for everybody else, we've got a future Andrew Torres on the line here to give us this week's lucky winner for TTGBE.
So, Thomas, for this week's winner, I chose Cargo 21. That is at Blackjack Ewok on Twitter, and everyone should give him a follow. His answer was, I choose A. Please tell me a successful impeachment has occurred. And while we certainly endorse the sentiment, we are in favor of all sorts of impeachments, witnesses and otherwise. Remember that this week the answer was C, which I think underscores just how difficult the question it was. How proud we are, Thomas, of you for getting 6 in a row correct and keeping that streak going. But we wanted to give a shout out to Cargo 21 at Blackjack Ewok, and who is really, really hoping for that successful impeachment, and we are too. Thanks.
All right. With that said, that's it for episode 99. Can you believe how many of these things we've done? It's been a good year. It's been a really good year. I don't know if this is officially our anniversary. It's got to be close, though, right? Or maybe we already passed it, actually. But either way, we've been doing this for a year, and it's been really fun, really fast. And never more vital, I don't think. I mean, it's so cool to be doing this with you, Andrew. I really enjoy it.
I'm up for doing another year. Are you up for that?
No, I'm quitting, but it has been fun up until now. No, I'm down. I'm definitely down. This podcast is going to see the end of the Trump administration. So at least another week or two.
There you go. And don't forget, at episode 101, we're changing our intro quotes. So if you're a patron, get on over to that Patreon thread and participate in uploading your favorite clips. And who knows, maybe they will be one of the lucky 4 out of like 9 million. We always get a ton of these, but you have a chance.
Yeah, but it's fun, and thanks for participating, everybody. Patreon.com/law. Get over there. There's lots of cool stuff. All right. See you guys next episode.
Stop breaking the law, asshole!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
The first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at caskers.com.